about the Green Book when you were asked to do this documentary?
It was divine timing. I mean, no, it's amazing. This is what I am also very excited about is that the fiction film has given visibility to this piece. And hopefully people will, you know, their interest will be piqued by the fiction film, no matter what happens on Sunday night. And then they will come and watch this documentary.
So the Oscars Sunday night and your film, The Green Book Guide to Freedom, will premiere on Monday night on Smithsonian Channel. Yoruba Richen, director and writer of The Green Book Guide to Freedom, professor in the documentary program in the Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at CUNY. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for full-time one-year paid news fellowship. Details at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Waronoff, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud. Special thanks to Miriam Barnard, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey.
Please join WHFR.FM 89.3 for blues music on Highway 61 Friday 2 till 4 p.m. Each week, DJ Kitty Love brings the best in new blues releases and Detroit blues to Henry Ford College Radio, WHFR.
Lifelong Dearborn resident and HFC alumni, Gary Ciccarelli has illustrated everything from posters of Elvis to U.S. Treasury bonds to Disney posters to superhero trading cards, video games, toy boxes, board games, cereal boxes, Star Wars books, and many other products have featured his artwork. See his personal favorites now through March 15th in the McKenzie Fine Arts Center's Sisson Art Gallery, located here on the Henry Ford College campus. For more information, including gallery hours, please visit sisson.hfcc.edu. That's sisson.hfcc.edu.
Listener-supported, non-commercial radio from the campus of Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn.
Welcome to this edition of the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here, along with Alan Mazurek. And Alan, welcome to Michigan again. We haven't gone anywhere, clearly, because the weather is it's everywhere. It's up and down and all around. But we've had some sunshine, which is always a pleasure to see.
And we've had some snow. We've had a little bit of everything. Is the love gone? I know last week was love week, but is the love gone or is it still out there somewhere?
Never. It's never gone. Never gone. One thing that we love, at least I'll tell you I love, and that is the ability to be a faculty member here at Henry Ford College. One of my favorite things about my position is being able to work with, alongside, and be represented by a gentleman by the name of John McDonald. And he, for 40 years, has represented our Union Local 1650 as its esteemed president. Aside from that, 50 years as an instructor at Henry Ford College. So talk about history. And I'm very
excited. Out of an
80-year
history. So let's put that in perspective. It's,
way over the halfway point, huh?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, good observation. And we're going to have John in studio a little bit later to talk about his tenure here, what he's always actively participating in, and maybe some fond memories from these past 40 to 50 years. So that'll be coming up in a little bit. But we are looking forward to learning more about our library here on the campus of Henry Ford College, which has been around for a very long time as well. Somebody that hasn't been around for as long as John McDonald, or maybe some of us, is our librarian, Tessa Betts. And Tessa's in studio today, and she's going to talk with us about some of the events going on through the library right now. A lot of things through the process of Black History Month, and then we'll have things for Women's Recognition Month, and they really are very good about timing events and opportunities and speakers and so on. But I'm looking forward to talking to Tessa about the topic of public domain and how how that could fall into some of our students' creative capacities a little bit, or just a general population, what we might need to know or want to know or thought we never, you know, cared to know, but now we do. So I'm going to let her talk about it. Well, let's jump right into it. We are excited to have Tessa Betts joining us at this time, our first time at WHFR Radio, as I recollect, Tessa. So it's a pleasure to have you here. And tell us a little bit about your time here at Henry Ford. It's been quick so far.
It has been quick. I started working here in the fall of 2016. And so I'm a short timer, but I hope to be a very long timer. I don't know if I'll get 50 years in, but I'll try. So when I started at HFC, the library was trying to reach out to students. And so my official title is User Experience Librarian. Mm-hmm. So planning programs, having workshops. Every Monday we do free movie Mondays and I make popcorn. And so we try to get students to think of the library not just as a place to do homework, although it is that, but also a place where they can hang out on campus, because there's not always a lot of places where you can hang out on campus. So we want the library to be one of them.
Yeah, especially when the weather is like it is.
Yeah, when it's really cold, our heat works.
Yeah, so can't be sitting out on the grass playing
true.
Guitar like we would want to, so why not go in and do something stimulating? Yeah, very cool. A little bit about your background, if you would, coming
sure.
in to this position as officially User Experience Librarian.
Yeah, I've been a librarian for over 10 years. Most of that was at an academic library, Baker College, actually. But I also have experience working in public libraries, in teen services and youth services. In fact, sometimes I moonlight as a children's librarian on weekends because it's just fun. So I do have a lot of experience dealing with both students and the general public, and I like people, so that's why I want to be a librarian.
Right. Ellen, I don't know if you feel the same way, but I walk by the library every day, mm-hmm. multiple times, mm-hmm. and sometimes I look in longingly, like, oh, if I only had an extra 30 minutes. Oh, the things I would do, the opportunity to just sit and stare at the books or grab, you know, just grab something off the shelf and just try something new, you know, all those kind of things. But we have a tendency to kind of, well, we think that we're going to find the time and we don't, or we feel like, oh, it's too much going on. It's just not, we need to, you know, we sort of need to designate a component of time for that purpose. And we're, you know, teachers, but
right.
the students being pulled in 80 million different directions as well. What have been the biggest challenges getting those students, our students into the library for all these wonderful projects?
I think, yes, we do have a lot of students who hang out in the library, which is great, and we love to see them. As doing programs, sometimes they don't have time for it. So we try to plan events at different times of day mm-hmm. to try to give everybody a little bit of opportunity to come and join. For example, in April, on the 3rd, we're going to do an event called the Human Library, which we did last year and we did the year before. And it runs from 10 to 3, so... Oh. People can stop in. You don't have to be there the whole time. In fact, if anyone wants to volunteer to be a book, either of you want to be a book, you could talk about doing radio.
What kind of books? Yeah, what kind of books are you looking for?
You're well read. You can do this.
So human books can really be anything that you're willing to have one-on-one conversations with people about. Usually, it has something to do with some aspect of yourself that people might have a misconception about, or there might be a stereotype about, or maybe even a prejudice about, and then you agree to come and have one-on-one conversations. So you would be the book, kind of like AKA don't judge a book by its cover, human book, and then people can ask you questions and you can answer them, and it really gives people an opportunity to get to know different things and different groups and different people.
I could think of 20 things right now, Ellen, but I'm not going to mention any of them. But boy, that would be exciting. So you don't have to have written a book. You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to be a PhD.
You are the book. And you are an expert on yourself. So you already are an expert.
Yeah, how fun. That's very cool. And then students will come in and they'll check out a book or two. And you sit and you talk for 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah, about 15 minutes. Ask questions. Hear people's stories. Yeah, it's really popular. So we try to have it during, you know, a bigger part of the day so more people can come.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Let's talk about something. You recently had a discussion on the concept of public domain and new releases. So explain what that means, then we'll talk a little bit about copyright as well.
So public domain is when a copyright has expired, and then the work is out there freely available for anyone to use. And for a long time, things would just be in the public domain if it was... Copyright originally was supposed to be a little bit of protection so that artists and authors and creators could protect their work during their lifetime, make a little money off of it, and therefore encourage them to make more art and more literature and more music. It wasn't supposed to be a system so that your great-grandchildren can benefit from your royalties the way that it has turned into now. So originally, tons of things were in the public domain because a short period of time passed. Boom, anyone can use it. You want to republish William Shakespeare's works? Have at it. They're in the public domain. But
and by public domain, we mean they belong to everybody.
They belong to the public.
Correct. Yes.
The public owns them. So what happened over time is the law kept getting tweaked a little bit, special interests, if you will. And in 1998, Sonny Bono of Sonny and Cher sponsored this bill because the Disney Mickey Mouse was going to be in the public domain. And, well, Disney can't have that happen. We can't have Mickey Mouse in the public domain. Heaven forbid, what would people do with Mickey if they could do anything they wanted? That was their argument.
You don't want to ask.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Right. It's the internet. Yes. So there was, so Congress passed this bill that said that if you create something, you own it for the creator's lifetime plus 70 years after they're dead. So if you think about it, if you live to be, let's say you live to be 100, because you have great genes, so you live to be 100, and then you die, and then 70 years after you die, then people can actually get their hands on your work to work with it. That's a really long time. So for this year, in January, for the first time in decades, ever since this law passed, there were all of a sudden things that are in the public domain because enough time has passed since the author died. So things from 1924, if you find stuff from 1924, then you can actually use it. So there's some great works, like some of Robert Frost's poems are now in the public domain. You can go online and just do public domain and you can see what's available if you might want to use some things. And so it's kind of a big year for that. Is everyone's a little excited about public domain.
Well, and you know, when Alan pointed out sort of everyone owns this, the right to use this work, what would be an example of somebody really benefiting from waiting for something to go into public domain and then using it? Because you can't recopyright something, or can you?
Well, so
you see where I'm going.
When you create, so when you create something, you own the copyright. And when you own the copyright, you own, there are several things that you own the rights for. You own the right to, you know, sell it. You own the right to create all other works based on your
marketing
work.
And
marketing,
but sequels,
and all that kind of stuff. So when the copyright expires, someday J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter copyright will expire someday. And then if you want to rewrite the ending to Harry Potter because that epilogue was terrible, and it was, then you will be able to because it's out of copyright. So you could write a sequel. But right now, if you try to write a sequel, J.K. Rowling will sue you and has.
But you can write the sequel, but can you also publish the sequel and make money off of
the
sequel?
Yes, because it would be, because it's in the public domain and also you're creating a new work.
And if you create the new work, should you then copyright the
new work? Absolutely. And in fact,
even if, you know where we're going
again. Does that reset the clock on the original copyright?
It does reset the clock. And in addition to copyright, you know, getting a copyright, the minute that you create something and put it in a tangible form, you have the copyright. You don't have to, contrary to popular belief, you don't have to go and register it with the Copyright Office, although you can, and it does provide you extra extra
mail yourself
protection.
A certified envelope and put it in the safe deposit box and all that stuff.
That. Yeah. We've heard all that. Yeah.
So you don't have to. The minute that you have it in a tangible form, you own the copyright. So everyone at the school owns copyrights. It's just a given. We've all put something in tangible form. We all have copyrights.
Sure.
So yes, if you make a derivative work off of something that was in public domain, you own the copyright and you can do what you want.
It's just the proving it part is the hard part.
The proving it part can be the hard part. Now that we live in a digital age, it's a little bit easier if your content's published online or you've done some work with it, because there's probably a time date stamp somewhere and you can prove, hey, I emailed this person a link to my poem on this date, so obviously I'd published it by then. So it's a little easier in the digital world back when we had to do certified mail.
We're joined in studio with a spirited conversation with Tessa Betts, who is a librarian here at the Eshelman Library at Henry Ford College, user experience librarian, and boy, you're just in the right spot for what you do, Tessa. I love this energy. We have heard, I think, on a number of occasions about the performer, the diva, that tries to copyright a phrase or a statement. And I know diva Taylor Swift herself has done this on a number of occasions. So somebody else can't use, for example, the phrase, this sick beat, because it was in a song that she now, it's not only just the song, but even she owns the phrase, for crying out, which I think it blows my mind. And I know there's different things related to that kind of stuff. But how often does it go to that extreme?
Not super often.
Okay.
So here's the true thing about copyright is most of us who create stuff, because we all create things, are probably never going to make any money off of our things. Mm-hmm. In which case, for most of us, it's not worth it to try to, you know, trademark a phrase or to try to keep a really tight grip on our work. Maybe we want to share it a little bit more. Maybe we want a Creative Commons license on it. But some big powerhouses are making a lot of money off of something, and they don't want people just selling t-shirts with their lyrics on it, which I can understand. So it doesn't happen very often. And in situations like that, when it's your lyric that you came up with, okay. But if it's, here's another story from the publishing industry.
And a lot of that is sort of like momentary and transactional. No one's selling a lot of, you know, every day I'm shuffling kind of t-shirts right now, right?
I don't know. I've seen them.
Yes.
It's true.
So it also depends on how popular you think it's going to be, how much money you think it would make you, or if it would do damage to your image. Taylor Swift has a very definite image. And if people took her lyrics and started doing something not good with them, that could hurt her image. Although parody is still legal. You can still make a parody.
That's exactly. I was just going to bring that up. I mean, there is the ability.
Weird Al's whole career.
Shout out to Weird
Al. Is built on parody. And yeah, that's, you go back to the Jerry Falwell parody ad in Hustler magazine and things like that. That's a well-established part of law.
Yes, you can always make a parody. Hopefully, your parody is good. Weird Al's parodies are very good. If you didn't know,
some of them are.
Yes, but Weird Al actually makes it a practice to ask the artist that he's going to parody if it's okay with them.
Aww.
Because even though he has every legal right to make a parody and put it on an album and do it in shows, he has every legal right to do it, he's trying to be a good guy and making sure, hey, Coolio, by the way, that Gangster's Paradise song, I got this idea. So he doesn't have to, but he does it, which I appreciate.
Oh,
and
that's nice.
It's like asking permission, but for something you don't have to.
You mentioned a word a few minutes ago, Creative Commons.
I was literally going to ask that exact same question.
No, I copyrighted, literally. I trademarked that question first, all right?
You did.
Let's
you did.
Be clear.
I accept.
And what exactly the concept of Creative Commons is, because it seems something that's kind of, for some of us, hard. Yeah, right, exactly. Hard to wrap your head around.
Sure. So Creative Commons is, a concept where in content creators, whatever your content is, maybe you want to share your work because you either acknowledge you're probably not going to get paid from it, or your work is actually something that the world would benefit from. So I like to encourage a lot of faculty maybe are writing their own course materials, creating their own textbook type materials. That would be stuff that would be fantastic if they wanted to do Creative Commons type licenses on them, because that would mean students could have access to them and not have to pay exorbitant textbook prices in order to get the class materials. So there are six different Creative Commons license that you can put on your work. So as I said before, the minute you put something in tangible form, you own the copyright. Because you own the copyright, you can also choose if you want to put a different type of copyright on it, like a Creative Commons. You could choose to have your work immediately go into the public domain where you don't care what happens to it. Nobody does this, but you could do this. The most broad Creative Commons license is you just want credit. So it's called a CC BY BY. So all you're saying is, hey, use my stuff, remix my stuff, share my stuff. Just say that it's my stuff.
Make sure everybody knows it's my stuff.
And that's the most broad one. And then the most restrictive one is what's called a BY with non-commercial and no derivatives. So that basically means all you can do with it is you can use it, you have to give credit, you can't make any money off of it, and you could share it with people, but you have to share it exactly as it is. So let's say there was a song I really liked and I wanted to share it and it had this license on it. I could share it. I would say, you know, a song by Susan. And then, but I can't do anything to it. I can't, you know, take out that middle part that I didn't really like as much. I can't.
Come on, that was the best part.
Right, I know. Jeez. I can't edit it in any way. I have to just present it as is, and I can't make any money off of it. So I can't sell ad time on my YouTube channel or anything. So that's the most restrictive one, which is not really in the spirit of creative copyright, but it's a choice that people can make. So there's lots of different ways you can share your work.
It's a way of distributing it without the, I guess the annoyance of hiring lawyers to protect it for you.
Right. And if you think that your work, if you want to share your work because you want other people to riff on it, then CC licenses are really good for that. And it also, that's how knowledge gets transmitted in the world. If you don't put a Creative Commons license on it, then it is bound by copyright. If you're not really famous and you don't have a corporate entity behind you, someday you're going to die. And then your work's going to be known as what's called an orphan work, which means it might never really make it anywhere. It might just die with you, because remember, at 70 years after you die, but if nobody knows you, nobody knows when you died, nobody knows, you don't have an estate, nobody can track down your next of kin, if they wanted to use your work, then it's just kind of gone forever because nobody can prove when it's in the public domain. So there's a lot of
orphan
works out there.
So we can always sing certain nursery rhymes and
yes.
include them. Let me ask you one question here is, in a digital age, how does, you know, something like crowdsourcing work when it comes to either copyright or Creative Commons? If I'm an author and I'm just basically crowdsourcing my material, who owns that material, or who gets to say that belongs to me?
That is a good question. So it kind of boils down to, when was it in a tangible form? So if, when you're crowdsourcing it, if nobody ever puts it all together except for you, if you're the one who puts, you know, you and your five buddies are sitting around and you're riffing on, you know, you're going to write the next big hit. And everybody puts a line, you know.
Someone says the line.
Someone says the line, right? But that person didn't put it in tangible form. They're just, you're all sitting around BSing with some beers, and you're the one who goes to all the trouble of writing out the lyrics and writing the music. Then it's yours. Even though if you were good person, you'd give your buddy a little nod saying, but Jim over here is really the one who came up with the, you know, the hook. It gets a little trickier in digital format when people are, if it's in tangible form. So if you're passing emails back and forth, then it's in a tangible form. It has your name on it. It's even got a time date stamp. So in that instance, if it was me, I would err on the side of caution and have all of those people be co-authors on whatever the thing is, because there's a paper trail or a digital paper trail, so that anyone could take the credit for it. So you would probably want to give everyone the credit for it.
But they didn't do it, and that's how the band broke up.
Probably.
The rest is history.
Not for the first time.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we are just about out of time, but this has been a fascinating interview. I have to ask, if somebody wants to see what is out there now on public domain, and also if somebody's interested in creating a legit copyright through the U.S. Copyright Office, how do we do those two things?
When things go in public domain, is it just like a yearly download, or
is it day by day?
No, it's a yearly thing, because day by day would be too crazy.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
So in January of every year, whatever the year's worth of public domain stuff, boom, it goes on. I want to say like public domain. Gov, but I could be wrong.
Gov or net, whatever.
If you just Google public domain, what's in the public domain, it'll take you to what's in the public domain. And Project Gutenberg is a bunch of stuff in the public. There's lots of different places you can go and find stuff in the public domain. In fact, the like search engines for images like Bing and Google, you can search by public domain so you can see what images are freely available. YouTube has a way you can search for that. There's lots of different mechanisms based on what you're looking for. And Creative Commons is just creativecommons.org.
And that applies to basically contemporarily created works where the person who authors them or publishes them is surrendering part of their rights to it.
So Creative Commons, they're still alive, whereas public domain, they've been dead for a while.
Got it. Final question. What is up with that happy birthday song, for crying out loud? Why some restaurants were not allowed to sing it?
Well,
that's why we sing that different version of it. I just think they like that weird version that they made up. But what's up with that? I've always wanted to know.
So there was a case, the happy birthday case, about somebody had claimed that they owned the copyright to Happy Birthday. And then it turns out that the song Happy Birthday and the arrangement were actually published years prior in some random old, like, folklore songy type book. And so that person who was that money-grubbing person who didn't want people to sing Happy Birthday, they lost their case because it was in a tangible form before their version of Happy Birthday. So they don't own the copyright. So, you know, Chili's or Olive Garden could sing Happy Birthday if they wanted to. But I think you're right. I think they're so into their version of it now that they don't bother. But yes, you can
it's
sing
It's become their
Happy
own
birthday.
Trademark. To
yeah, that's
exactly.
right. That's right.
Yes. Exactly.
So we're off the hook.
You're off the hook. You can sing all the happy birthdays you want.
Okay. I was very concerned. You have just been a wealth of information, Tessa. Thank
anytime.
You. If we have a listener that wants to get a hold of you just to talk about this, other aspects of what's going on at the library here on the HFC campus, how can we reach you?
You can always come visit the library. I am working Monday through Friday.
Which building letter is it?
It's B.
I was going to say E would be too easy, but yes, building B. Okay,
building B. And you can also email me tbetts the number 2 at hfcc.edu, or come visit. We like visitors.
Right. Very good. I always made up something to go with each letter, and it's to me the logical thing is B for books. So that's how I remember the library. I know it's more than books, but that's just a little tip. Yeah, little FYI.
What's A for?
All those other things, yeah. We're in building M, and I always say it's because the restaurant's in our building, so it's for
Nice. I like it.
Anyway, moving forward, yeah, don't get any ideas of copyright Creative Commons people. I got that. We thank you for your time. We wish
you
a great rest of your semester, and let's step back again sometime, okay?
Sure, anytime.
Great.
We'll be back with more on the WHFR Journal, where we're always hashtag making waves.
There's a spring in the mountain, and it flows down to the town.
From from NPR Music and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Welcome to another Mountain Stage with your host, Larry Gross.
For more than 30 years, Mountain Stage with Larry Gross has been the home of live music on public radio. Each two-hour episode of Mountain Stage can be heard every week on WHFR, Wednesday evenings from 6 to 8 p.m. Recorded in front of a live audience, Mountain Stage features performances from seasoned legends and emerging stars in genres ranging from folk, blues, and country to indie rock, synth pop, world music, alternative, and beyond. So join us here at WHFR.FM, the station making waves, on Wednesday evenings from 6 to 8 p.m. for Mountain Stage with Larry Gross.
Hey, America, we're your pets, and this song's dedicated to those people who don't have health insurance yet.
In Roe, we say, we want you to be okay. In Roe, we say, take care, people, for goodness sake. There's a plan for every budget, so don't accept defeat. Now you can get covered and still
buy me treats.
Enroll! So listen to me, a talking pug, you see. If you get health insurance, preventive care is now free.
So sweet.
You take care of your pets. Now it's their turn to take care of you. Visit GetCoveredAmerica.org to learn about your health insurance options. That's GetCoveredAmerica.org.
And take care, people!
Brought to you by Get Covered America and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw here, along with Alan Mazurek. And hello, one of my very favorite people on the campus of Henry Ford College is sitting in with us now, and that is the one and only John McDonald, who is coincidentally, not really, but celebrating such a huge milestone in his career. We felt it was only fitting to bring John in and talk a little bit about what's on his mind here after earning the right to brag a little bit about being the president of our Local 1650, our teachers union here at Henry Ford College, 40 years as local president. In addition, 50 years as a faculty member here at Henry Ford College. So if that doesn't earn you bragging rights, gee, I don't know what does. So congratulations on all of these accomplishments, John, and welcome to our studios.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. We are... I am, and I think others in our local, most everyone in our local is kind of in awe of the stamina and energy that you have maintained over since the time that we as individuals have met you, and then we kind of research and do our own history on this person that we have at the head of our organization, and then looking to where we kind of fall off and start to get into some maybe routines and things. You keep moving it forward, and as a good leader does, but also as one that does it with such a pizzazz and such intensity that you do. Where do you get that from? Where does that come from every day?
Well, in part, I think from the people I represent. When you represent an outstanding group of people, and it's been generations now of faculty that I've represented, they inspire you. The wonderful compliments you just paid me, you could pay to virtually any faculty member on this campus. And they deserve to be well represented. And I really feel strongly that a professional staff should be represented professionally. They should have professional compensation. They should have professional standing. They should have a voice in what they are experts in. And I have been here through presidencies that have been very successful and very positive, and through a couple of negative ones. And I really feel that our faculty deserve an administration that appreciates them. I think we have that now. So the energy that the last 10 years have taken has been quite severe. I'm looking forward to something of a respite in the near future. So,
wow.
But again, thank you for the compliments.
Wow. You're very welcome and well deserved. Not only serving at this capacity, at our level, but also serving at a national level now for a number of years, brings its own level of challenges and exhaustive meetings and discussions and so on, just to keep that movement moving forward. How has that been? How has your experience at the national level been as vice president nationally?
Really stimulating rather than exhaustive.
Good.
I've had the opportunity. I've been fortunate to work with some very impressive people at the state level. Our state affiliate president, David Hecker, is a phenomenal representative of labor in this state. And every point in my career where I've begun to think I've got to do something new, the American Federation of Teachers has offered me a new opportunity. So at the national level, I have met people from across the nation, very inspiring people, very dedicated people, committed to justice, social justice. And I've had the good fortune of going overseas for the American Federation of Teachers and meeting like-minded people across the globe. But it is not exhausting at all. It's reinvigorating.
Wow. What an attitude. The climate has changed over the years at our campus, as we know, and you said generations, literally generations.
Yeah.
What have been some of the biggest changes at the state level, let's just say, and even nationally for not only unions, which I think we can all speak to a little bit, mm-hmm. but this particular type of representation? What have been the major hurdles that you felt that you've had to really, really pull up the straps to overcome?
Well, it's been a difficult 10 years at the college itself, but that's reflected at the state and the national level. The teaching profession has become a whipping boy of ideologues from the far right that have decided that they want to dominate the political scene, the economics of this country, and public employee unions are pretty much the last vestige of defense against that agenda. And so if you look at the federal level, funding of higher ed, it's true of the state level as well, is not what it should be. At the state level, our college is no exception. Our revenue stream was once 50% provided by the state and maybe less than 20% from tuition. You can flip those numbers now, and the students are now covering about 50% or more of our revenue stream, and the state government is covering perhaps less than 20% now. And that has resulted in massive student debt. We are at $1.5 to $1.75 trillion in student debt across this country. Community colleges being probably the most economical way one can pursue a higher education, but still, it is burdensome. And that debt load is greater than the debt load that caused the Great Recession of a few years ago. So you have students who cannot purchase homes, cannot wed, cannot be productive members in the economy. They're paying off their loans at age 50, 60, 70 years of age. So funding at both the state and the federal level. Federal level, Perkins money and Pell Grant particularly are always under siege. They do not keep up with the cost of living. They do not support students who come from socioeconomic backgrounds that really require a lot of assistance and support. That is one area, but there are countless other areas that student violence on campuses. I just returned from Florida, visiting Parkland, Florida, mm-hmm. which witnessed about a year ago 17 killings at that facility. And the faculty have remained committed to those students. Faculty have volunteered to go there in order to be of assistance and to protect students, as the current faculty have. But it's become almost a high-security facility, and it's tragic in this country where there's so much gun violence that K-12 systems, school districts, community colleges are vulnerable. And it's very difficult for students and faculty and other staff to function in that kind of environment. So economy, fiscal support, violence, the type of student we're dealing with now who comes from a very challenging background that that in the past might have found a very meaningful life in manufacturing. They're coming to us now, and they need our support. They need wraparound services. They need education that can make up for deficiencies that they've experienced already before they get here. So it's a challenging time.
Now, there's problems, there's challenges, and then what kind of things does an organization work for in terms of solutions? What goes on between election days? And it's one thing to have, a slate of candidates to say that we approve these. And just for those who don't know, what's going on, in those two-year intervals? What kind of advocacy, what kind of work?
Well, historically, not enough. And that's a problem that the labor movement is addressing. But too often, one seeks a solution when an election is around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And my view is once an election's done, the next election has begun. Mm-hmm. You have to find candidates. You have to groom them. You have to educate them on the issues. And you have to really make voting more accessible to the general public than it is. But the labor movement, and the AFT in particular, and the NEA, are very supportive of communities in need, whether it's a natural disaster, a man-made disaster. AFT and NEA and other education unions have gone in and tried to relieve the problems that these disasters produce. And I think there's been a sea change in the last midterm election. You have a lot of people elected to office who recognize what the problems are in this country and have an agenda to address them. And not only the fiscal underfunding of education in general, violence, student debt, the opportunities to immigrant populations to realize what we all realized. We're all immigrant populations, a generation or two off, perhaps, from the arrival of our ancestors. But so there's activity of a non-political nature always going on, but the political work never stops. And the right-wing ideologues have the resources, the money, and the power that we can only counter with activism, legwork, and education.
John McDonald is joining us in studio here at WHFR, celebrating at the end of 2018, 50 years of service to Henry Ford College, Community College.
What did this place look like 50 years ago?
Yeah.
I'll be honest with you.
I'll tell you what John looked like 50 years ago, exactly what he looks like now.
Oh,
maybe a little more
You
hair,
need a union that has a vision program. You know.
I'm telling you. Yeah. I've seen those pictures.
Yeah. There are optometrists and ophthalmologists out there just looking for people like you to help. Actually, I have more than 50 years here. I was a student of Henry Ford College. I arrived on this campus 2 years after it was built as a student and finished that associates, went on and did a bachelor's, a master's at U of M, and came back here. I used to brag about coming back at 22 because it made me sound young. There's no denying my age anymore. But it was a small campus. It was a brand new campus, but it was a small campus, about four or five buildings. The library was part of the first floor of the liberal arts building at that time. But what has really changed is the demographic we serve. Essentially, in those days, it was middle class, upper middle class kids from suburbs, and now it is the diversity is immense and rewarding.
I was going to say one of the true strengths, just from my perspective,
yeah.
Of the institution.
Yeah, quite frankly, I grew up in Detroit, but I grew up in a white neighborhood. I went to a private high school. And I had the good fortune of getting a job in college in an inner city library. So I began to be exposed to diversity that I never really witnessed. And the campus over the years has done the same. We serve a large segment of the Detroit population, the Arab American population in this community. I wish we served more, and I think Mr. Cavallin, our president, has as a goal serving the Hispanic or Latino communities, because they're right on our border, and it would be a real addition to the diversity of the staff. When I hired in, there were relatively few women. Among the full-time faculty, over 50% of full-time faculty are now female. We probably have about 15 to 18% African-American. Should be a little higher than that. Probably about 15 to 18% Arab-American. It's been an education for people who've been around a long time to experience those cultures. And I've learned a lot about the Arab-American culture. I knew a little bit growing up about the African-American culture. But that's the major change. Bricks and mortar, we've got a lot more bricks and mortar.
No doubt about it. That's not a heart and soul of an institution.
That's
either,
right. That's just bricks and mortar. Yeah. As cold as it sounds, that's what it is.
It looks good on paper, sure. And it looks good to drive by. But yes, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, you started in your college career academically as an English professor. Yes.
Yep.
And what drew you to that?
Well, actually, as an undergrad, I was a history major. One of the few times in my life I've exercised sound judgment, I looked and I saw history is an elective and English is a required course. Where will the job opportunities be? So I wound up a double major. I don't regret it. I enjoy history a great deal and reading history. Literature is, and my focus was 19th century American literature, so somewhat historical there. But I found out, as many people do when you come to community college, you on occasion may teach a literature course, but primarily you're teaching composition or developmental English.
Mm-hmm.
So then your favorite book, 19th century American literature.
Favorite book? I have several favorite authors.
There you go.
Emily Dickinson, Walt Whitman, probably among the top. Mark Twain is Ralph Waldo Emerson. He's tough to wade through. Henry David Thoreau.
Okay.
So those would be my top three or so. I have not visited there. I've visited Thoreau's town. I would love to see Emily Dickinson's town. Someday when I'm in New York, I'll go over to Camden, New Jersey, and see where Whitman lived. And there's diversity right there.
Yeah, know. Right, exactly.
Whitman was gay, and Dickinson was clearly female.
Yep.
And Henry David Thoreau was an outdoors kind of guy, and pretty much an independent spirit. So, but it's a rich period of history and literature.
I find that when you talk to someone that has had the fortune, the pleasure of having some constant in their career, in their life, and this is quite a constant, 40, 50 plus years, John, in these capacities here at Henry Ford. Oftentimes, while the climate may change and the visuals around might change, it's hard to really think back at how you have as a person have changed. And so I wonder if you could just sort of explore, just for a minute, if you could think of a couple of things that maybe you feel differently about than when you started, or maybe at the halfway point, or just some of the evolution of John McDonald. Because I got to tell you, Alan, and I've said this publicly on a number of occasions, and I think a couple of times to John directly, we're looking at the smartest man on this campus. I'm telling you, the smartest man on this campus.
You just made about 100 enemies for me.
I don't care.
I'm in the room, so you got a 50-50 yeah. chance,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
You've got to be right.
I
yeah.
stand by my decision.
I do not necessarily disagree
yeah,
with you.
Yeah,
how's
yeah,
that?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, disagree with her. She's wrong.
No.
No,
but what's you've affected change. You have been a part of change. But what's changed about you, looking back?
Well, it can't be improvement. I mean, I was there from the. No, actually, a lot of things have changed. People don't believe it, but when I first came here and took on the presidency of the Federation, I was a pretty shy guy. I was really shy. I found it difficult to deal with what's became very, very important as a union president. That's community interaction, community relationships. And over time, and I think it took time, it took a sense of growing confidence and maturity to begin to relate. Now, I had some mentors that were very important. Joe Halisi, who some people may remember, was the consummate connection to the community. He had a personality larger than life. He volunteered for everything. He supported every charity. He knew everyone. Everyone owed him a favor. And for some reason, he took me under his wing and introduced me to a lot of very important people. And he was always volunteering, and eventually we were pretty much sidekicks, and someone would say, we need somebody to work on something, he'd raise his hand, and it dawned on me eventually, when he raised his hand, I would do the work. And I said, stop it, Joe, you're killing me. But through him, I met Mike Adre, I met John Dingell, I met a tremendous number of people, and I think at some point I decided that humor was an entree, and the more self-deprecating the humor, the better the entree. And once I got to know someone, we'd exchange the jabs and the camaraderie. But that was a major change. And the other changes, there are many, but becoming involved in something larger than the campus, state union work, national union work, you're always growing and learning in that regard. And eventually, if you're around long enough, people think you're brilliant because you've seen everything, not because you're brilliant. We just said, but you've seen everything. And so you can become the wise elder statesman just by showing them that that was tried before and it was unsuccessful, or that was tried before and it was successful. I'm inclined to be a little analytical. I entertained the thought of law school at one time. But family was pretty time-consuming, and so I stayed in teaching. I don't regret anything at all, except I miss the classroom. I don't miss reading the papers. I don't miss that at all. And all the bureaucracy that's been associated now with teaching, all of the paperwork that's being imposed by accrediting agencies and others, I think I would have had difficulty with, and I would have difficulty if I were back in the classroom. But to be around young people and students is keeps you young. It does.
You mentioned the word community a number of times, and not just through calling us Henry Ford Community College, which we say you can take the name out of it, but you're never taking the community out of it.
You can take the concept out of it.
Yeah, but right, it's just, no, that's what we're about. But
right.
Through people like Joe Halisi and Mike Adre and others, the true leaders in our community as business owners and as representatives, organizationally speaking, do you have a favorite place in your heart for a specific aspect of some project that you worked on collectively, or an organization you were connected to? Because I know you've served in so many capacities, and also as chair of the Mike Adre Memorial Golf Outing, funding scholarships for students for so many years. So, what do you think?
Well, that was something to chair that golf outing, since I couldn't hit a golf ball with. With a baseball bat, you know, or something. But it was an opportunity to honor Michael and honor Joe, who was his idea, and to get to know George Bednar and Jim Doyle and other really major players who really did the work. I just stood up and talked, and they did the work. And I miss that event a lot. Maybe we'll try to resurrect it one day, or something akin to it. I think working on millage campaigns was exhausting but very rewarding, because the community, every time the community would respond positively. It's an amazing community. And I think it's important to note that the fact we have such a large immigrant population has kept Dearborn vibrant, has kept this college alive, because that immigrant population really understands what education means as an entree to the American dream. The sense of family and community that you see in the Arab American community is never ceases to amaze me. But currently you have people who stepped into the shoes of Mike Hadrey and Joe Halisi, Gary Kuhlman being a phenomenal example of someone who really works his heart out for the community. There's a gentleman named Patrick D'Ambrosio that is behind the scenes in lots of charitable events. And if you haven't gone to Pat's pasta dinners for the animal shelter, raising funds for the animal shelter, it's great food and a great cause. But the more you're involved, the more people you meet, the more relationships you develop, and the more your positive view of human nature is enhanced. And so it's been very rewarding.
So with everything that's been fought for and won and defended over the last 40 years, when we have this conversation 40 years from now, what more do you hope will have happened?
I'll probably be very quiet 40 years from now. But which a lot of people are looking forward to.
Oh.
Whenever my voice starts to go as it is today, I think it reinforces faith in the power of prayer, you know, among many folks. But 40 years from now, it's difficult to predict where we'll be 40 years from now. We're going to be even more diverse than we are now. Probably people like me will be distinctly in the minority. White males, white females will be in the minority. It's going to be a country of people of color. That's first of all. My hope is that they'll do something about poverty and something about opening the doors for immigrants and disadvantaged people to really take part in the American dream. Technology, who knows where it's going to take us?
Yeah, it's incomprehensible.
It is. It's incomprehensible. Sometimes it's frightening. And so, you know, can with technology, can we maintain work for the population that we'll have? I mean, how much work is out there that human beings will be left to perform? And if there isn't, then you've got a real social and economic issue to come to grips with. I'm concerned presently about the future of our country and the future of democracy. I think that the oligarchs are... I sometimes worry that the period in time in which I lived was a blip, that the rich and oligarchs and powerful controlled everything, and World War II came along, and there was no denying the veterans who came home from that war their opportunities. And you had that period of time in which the middle class was built, and there was opportunities for everyone. And are we losing that now? Was that a blip in history, or is that something that's going to continue? So I'm not a real 40 years out. I sometimes wonder about tomorrow. So
well put. Yeah. One way or the other, definitely well put. Yes.
Well, I can tell you something that 40 years from now will be happening on the first floor of our Eshelman Library. There will be representation of John McDonald as of this year to honor John's 40th year as president of Local 1650. Officers of the Union of the Local created a section in your honor called the Library of Labor Studies, and as we have seen, it chronicles the history of labor relations, particularly Detroit labor relations, and what an opportunity for students to learn things that might make them the, I don't want to say the John McDonald's of our future, that's not possible, but the, to be able to sort of fall into those footsteps and be able to take a cause and run with it and do it in an academic and an intelligent and a kind and insightful way. So that's a great legacy.
Well, for those who want to be the John McDonald of the future, how do they get involved? What kind of work can people do to start to continue this?
Well, they can get involved, to say the obvious.
Yeah, sure.
I never thought I would have the role I had. I was brought up in a marginal middle-class situation. My dad was a Republican, and when I did some things when I first got here, such as suing the district for laying myself and some other people off, my father thought I'd be a pariah forever in the world of employment. But I learned early on, you don't let bullies get away with bullying. You confront them, and they're cowards ultimately. And they'll hide behind all sorts of things, but you can take them down. And that's one of the things that drives me when I see people being taken advantage of. It just, I relate to that, and I take them on. But how do you get involved? Well, you decide early on, well, at any point in life, that you want to make a change, or you want to contribute, or you want to leave the world a little better place than when you found it. And you pick your, and maybe you can do that on a large scale, maybe you do it on a small scale, but you do it. Now, you can take degrees now in labor studies and labor relations, but I think most people have come up from the rank and file. They've risen from being in the trenches to deciding to do something to improve the quality of life in the trenches. So, and you seek mentors. And I had my mentors.
So I was going to say, that's a very important part of it, is having those mentors.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just pulling up the famous quote by your very favorite Ralph Waldo Emerson. His whole thing, what you just said, inspired me to think of that famous line, to leave the world a bit better, whether by a healthy child, garden patch, or redeemed social condition, to know that even one life has breathed easier because you have lived, that is to have succeeded. And, boy, that sounds like John McDonald.
No, I enjoy Emerson. Teaching Emerson is another game.
Well, Susan McGraw, John McDonald, we hope that this last hour has left our world a little better place with all the discussion that we've had as a part of the WHFR Journal, and we hope our loyal listeners will agree with us. We're pretty much out of time. Why don't we just wrap up the show for today?
Let's wrap it up. Thank you so much, John, for your kind words, your continued support of this wonderful college, and your dedication and compassion to the cause, and always just the nicest person you ever want to talk to. And I like being on that end. I like being on the nicest person, and as opposed to the other side where
there's probably a few past presidents that would disagree.
Well,
I'm sure.
That's okay.
I certainly hope so.
Continued success, and thank you for your time today.
Well, thank
John.
You. You're very kind.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
We also thank Tessa Betts from the library, and don't forget, you can check out that collection of labor relations historical pieces at the Library of Labor Studies in John's honor, as well as so many other wonderful things going on at the library, and we had a pleasant discussion on public domain and so much more. We thank you for listening today. Always a pleasure to have you as a part of our WHFR audience of loyal listeners. Thank you, Alan, for working all the controls, as always.
Indeed. It's a pleasure, as always. We're going to hand the controls back to Kitty Love, who's going to hop in the car and take us down Highway 61. How's that?
Sounds great. Thank you.
With so many varieties of jazz out there, what do you choose on any given day? Well, you can tune in to my show, Terrence Tyson, your host, each and every Sunday from 10 a.m. until 1 p.m., and we'll help solve the mystery by playing it by ear. That's the Play It By Ear Jazz Show every Sunday from 10 until 1, right here on the station Making Waves, WHFR.FM 89.3 from Henry Ford College. Come join me each and every Sunday, and we'll solve the mystery by playing it by ear.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio, featuring local and independent artists.